So today, the day after Super Tuesday, and after voters in 15 states picked their presidential nominee, what has seemed inevitable for months is now clear.
This race is going to be a Trump-Biden rematch, which polls have shown for many months now most voters do not want, but they both swept states on Tuesday night, and they are very close, both of them, to clinching the nomination.
Especially now, with Nikki Haley exiting the race on the GOP side and with Dean Phillips ending his campaign on the Democrat side, it is President Biden and former President Donald Trump racing to the election in November, with plenty of hurdles ahead.
I think each candidate is looking at the others, seeing where they can capitalize. So I know the Biden camp sees significant weaknesses in Trump's performance. Obviously, Trump is leading in a lot of polls recently, and so the Trump camp sees a lot of openings. But I think the primary contests up to this point have shown they both have a lot of weaknesses to overcome before the fall.
Yasmeen Abu Talib is a White House reporter for The Post. She's closely tracking the campaigns. And one of the challenges facing Biden that's gaining steam is the uncommitted vote to protest his support of Israel's war in Gaza.
And I think the important thing is, you know, that the Biden campaign and some Democrats will dismiss it as a not sizable share of the vote. But in an election that's poised to be as close as this one, Biden cannot afford to alienate more voters over his foreign policy because his biggest liability in this race already is his age.
And that is where Vice President Kamala Harris comes in.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Please have a seat.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers, and it's Wednesday, March 6th. Today, we talk with Yasmeen about the challenges facing Biden and how Kamala Harris fits into the picture now. We'll also hear about expectations ahead of tomorrow's State of the Union speech. It's a big moment for Biden as he tries to tamp down anxiety about his campaign before November. Tell me more about what you saw in the Super Tuesday results that demonstrates some weakness for Biden, considering that he's like basically not running against anyone or not running against anyone who had any shot of winning, you know? So like, what is there to glean from that?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Biden is on paper, he should be sort of sailing to a second term. He's an incumbent president. There's a pretty strong economy. He passed a lot of legislation in his first term. But polls are showing that he is a very weak candidate right now. His approval ratings are very low. And not only that, Democratic primary voters have been sending him a message in the last few primaries. So in Michigan last week, we saw a sizable uncommitted vote, about 13%.
And to be clear, that those uncommitted voters are people who are, our understanding is people who are protesting Biden's stance on Gaza and trying to send a message that, like, you don't have our vote unless things are to change in terms of how you're approaching Israel and Gaza.
Exactly. I should explain. So the uncommitted vote, you know, is you're not committing to any candidate. It's always used a little bit in every primary. But this year, there was this last minute effort in a few states, starting with Michigan, and then it sort of bled into these Super Tuesday states where people were using that vote as a protest vote to show President Biden that they are deeply opposed to his handling of the war in Gaza and that he needs to do a lot of work and dramatically change course if he wants to win these votes in November.
And how significant was that uncommitted contingent in what we saw on Super Tuesday?
So it varied by state. I think one important thing to note is these were not well-funded, well-organized efforts. These were last minute, and there was a pretty sizable vote in some states given those conditions. So in Minnesota, nearly 20% of voters chose the uncommitted option. Mm. Obviously, Michigan has a bigger Arab and Muslim population than Minnesota. There's still a sizable one in Minnesota. But what that indicated was that this is not just the Arab and Muslim community, that the progressive wing of the party, voters of color, are also very unhappy with Biden's handling of the war, and he needs to, they want him to change course as well. You also saw a not insignificant showing in North Carolina and in Colorado.
Yasmeen, I remember we had a conversation a couple weeks ago about Biden on Gaza, and the sense that I got generally was that at that point it seemed like Biden shifting on his support for Israel was essentially a non-starter. I'm curious if you have gotten the sense now that the White House and that the Biden campaign has been paying attention to both the Michigan primary results, what we saw yesterday, in terms of having to acknowledge that significant uncommitted contingent.
They're definitely noticing, and we've seen a significant rhetorical shift, but I still don't think we've seen a meaningful policy shift as a result of it. They're definitely worried, but the way that they're trying to address these concerns is by ramping up their rhetoric, being a little bit stronger, and calling on Israel to allow more aid in, and being a little bit more critical. But fundamentally, they're not changing their approach. They're still not calling for a permanent ceasefire, which is what these uncommitted voters have been asking for. They have started airdropping aid into Gaza, but that doesn't address the fundamental issue that aid is not getting in because Israel's not allowing it in and there are just catastrophic conditions. So they're doing these things to try to show people that they care and are changing, but it's not the policy shift that these voters are asking for.
And it's also been interesting to see Vice President Kamala Harris get involved in the Gaza question as well. Can you explain a little bit how she has been kind of put into the forefront of this?
Yeah, this week we saw her take a little bit more of a leading role in terms of at least the public response. And Harris has always been sort of the outreach to the younger, more progressive wing of the party for Biden. And so she was in Selma this week, which of course was a, you know, very symbolic location to deliver these remarks. And she called for a ceasefire in stronger terms.
The threat of Hamas poses to the people of Israel must be eliminated. And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire.
But ultimately, she was calling for the six-week ceasefire that Biden has called for, that the administration has been working on for several weeks now. She also echoed Biden's rhetoric that Israel had to allow aid, more aid in, and said no excuses. So she was stronger and more forceful in her delivery. She used some stronger language than Biden has used. But ultimately, it was the same message, I think, just delivered from a more effective communicator.
And to what extent is Harris actually, like, communicating directly with officials in Israel?
She's been communicating with officials quite extensively. She's been on a lot of the calls with Biden, with Netanyahu. She's spoken to Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, several times.
Madam Vice President, you have a meeting coming up this afternoon. What's
yes,
your message for Benny Gantz?
And then, of course, she met with Netanyahu's chief political rival, Benny Gantz, while he was in the U.S. this week at the White House.
The president and I have been aligned and consistent from the very beginning. Israel has a right to defend itself. Far too many Palestinian civilians, innocent civilians, have been killed. We need to get more aid in. We need to get the hostages out. And that remains our position.
And I will tell you, Netanyahu was furious about this. There were lots of reports that he did not support Benny Gantz's visit. He did not want him meeting with U.S. officials. And then he goes and meets with the vice president, national security advisor, you know, a number of key people in the White House.
I want to talk a little bit more about Harris's role here, because it does seem like for someone in her position where she is not considered a strength of the campaign, some people have described her as less popular than Biden, who's already struggling with his popularity, that like putting her in the role of like doing the most controversial thing. I don't know if I understand the strategy there. Like, why are they having Harris out there kind of taking on the communication role in this very thorny issue? And what does that tell you about how they see Harris's role going forward?
I think on the Gaza issue specifically, a big part of it is that Harris is much more comfortable playing that role than Biden. I think part of it is a difference in how the two are willing to talk about the conflict. So from the beginning, and we've reported on this, Harris has been pressing Biden to address the plight of Palestinians much more. In the first couple months of the conflict, Biden wouldn't talk a lot about what was happening in Gaza, other than to say Israel had to try to limit civilian deaths. Harris has been pressing him to address concerns of Islamophobia, to talk in more detail about what's happening in Gaza and Palestinian suffering. And so I think a big part of this is that, you know, she's met with family members of people who have lost dozens of family members in Gaza or who are trapped there. So she's just been more connected to this part of the conflict than Biden has. He has this, which we've talked about before, Martine, this deep-rooted, visceral attachment to Israel that has seemed to make it difficult for him to get to where he is now. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that it took him several months to get to this point. She is more comfortable there. And I think a lot of it is we've seen in different points of the conflict, she has wanted to step into that role because the president can't get there himself. Mm.
But still, like, even beyond Gaza, what does that say about, like, whether or not Harris is an asset for the Biden campaign right now?
Harris obviously has her own weaknesses, but I think the Biden campaign is trying to use her as an asset in a few different ways. So obviously she's younger. She's, you know, the first Black female vice president. That's a big role for her. That does make her popular among certain parts of the Democratic base. And she's more connected to the progressive and youth voter part of the party and people of color. So she's a more effective messenger to that part of the base, which polls show Biden is deeply struggling with right now. So even beyond Gaza, they have Harris out there talking about abortion and abortion rights.
We, all of us, are now called upon to advance the promise of freedom, including the freedom of every woman to make decisions about her own body, not the government telling her what to do.
In much more visceral terms than Biden is willing to, because he'll talk about the right to choose, but he won't talk about abortion in a lot of detail and won't use a lot of precise language to talk about it. Mm-hmm. She's obviously been doing this on Gaza now, and I think we'll probably see more of that. And she's just better at talking about some of these issues that matter to that voter base than Biden is. And I think because of his age, because of the era of politics he came up in, he just can seem out of touch with where a big part of the party is right now.
Interesting. So it sounds like your sense is that Harris is kind of the person that you get to talk about the tough things that Biden doesn't really want to talk about.
Yeah, I think you could probably sum it up that way. But there are the issues that they need to talk about to win. It's just that for some of these issues, Biden can't get there on his own or is not comfortable using the terms and the language and the rhetoric that I think key parts of the base want to hear.
But then there's also the sense that Biden, I mean, maybe not that Biden isn't comfortable talking at all, but that like the people around Biden are worried about him talking out of turn, saying a gaffe, like doing something that would further damage that effort to make him seem not old or not out of touch or not kind of incapable of communicating clearly on a policy issue. We saw that Super Bowl Sunday where, you know, usually the president does an interview that day. He didn't do that. Other opportunities for kind of media exposure that Biden has shied away from. So talk to me about, like, what is the thinking there of keeping Biden away from some of these more high-profile opportunities to speak directly to the American people? And is that a concern going forward?
It's a tricky balancing act that Biden's aides are trying to manage right now. On the one hand, they want to put him out there, show people that he's energetic, that he's up for the job, that they really don't need to be worried about his fitness for the job, because in their view, he's as sharp as ever. I think the tricky part is polls show that his age is a huge liability for him. Polls have shown over and over again that a majority of not just voters, but Democratic voters think he's too old for the job and don't want him as the candidate in large part because of his age. So I think their way to try to combat that is to show, yes, he's 81 and Biden has sort of leaned in more recently where he's made jokes about his age. He made a joke once that someone had quoted Socrates or something like that before a fundraiser and he said, oh yeah, I knew him.
By the way, I've been doing this a long time. I know I don't look that old, I know. I'm a little under 103.
So they're trying to find ways to deal with it. The campaign has a number of events they're thinking about and planning for the president to help quell some of these concerns about his age. But at the end of the day, I think there's only so much they can do about it. Vice President Harris obviously has other liabilities and concerns, and there are a lot of people concerned about the idea that she could be the president. In a lot of polls, you see not a ton of confidence in her ability to do the job, but she is younger, she's vibrant, and so those concerns that we're talking about with Biden don't apply to her in nearly the same way.
Yeah, because, I mean, Harris is basically like the chief talking point of Republicans right now, which is that a vote for Biden is a vote for President Kamala Harris, because the assumption is he's not going to be able to finish his second term in office, and that, like, that they feel, and I think perhaps rightly, that that is like an animating reason for Republican voters to get out in November, is to like prevent the Kamala Harris presidency. So like how effective is she if she is driving Republican turnout?
It's a great question. I think a lot of this, we just have to wait and see how it all plays out. There's this sort of double-edged sword where she's a more effective communicator to the key parts of the Democratic base that Biden is not doing so well with. Of course, like you said, she is an animating figure for Republicans. But I think there is some thought that the Republicans who are turning out and warning against a Kamala Harris presidency are not the ones who might swing and vote for Biden instead of for Trump. So when you're looking at those swing voters, moderate voters, a lot of the voters who have been turning out and voting for Nikki Haley in the primaries, I don't know how much of a motivator voting against Kamala Harris will be for those people. I think we just sort of have to wait and see how she does. But back to the Biden issue, I mean, I think their biggest issue in this campaign is, I don't know how much you can tell people when the facts are he is 81. And there's this sense that voters get when they look at him that he's not up to the job. And, you know, his aides will say, well, you should see him behind the scenes. He's constantly peppering us with questions.
But we don't see that, right? Like, they're not showing us that.
Exactly. We don't see that. And they guard him so closely. And the other thing is, Biden has always been a gaffe-prone politician. But now he's president. There's all these concerns about his age and his mental acuity, however unfounded. And so when he does have a gaffe, Republicans and even people beyond Republicans seize on them as evidence that he's not up to the job. I think the best example of this was after the Robert Hur report came out about Biden's handling of classified documents. That report was very unusual, and that part of the reason Hur said he was not going to try Biden is that he would come off as an elderly, well-meaning old man with a poor memory. Those mm-hmm. aren't the exact words, but that was, you know, the basic sort of gist of the report. Mm-hmm. And Biden comes out and has this press conference where he hits back. He's, you know, quick on his feet and taking questions from reporters. But then at the end, he mixes up the president of Egypt with the president of Mexico.
Initially, the president of Mexico, Sisi, did not want to open up the gate to allow humanitarian material to get in.
And that's all anyone remembers from that press conference. And even Democrats after that press conference were like, why did he do that? That was such a disaster. He called this press conference to put to rest concerns about his memory, and then he has a flub like that. For another politician, that could just be viewed as a flub, but for Biden...
And for him 10 years ago, that would be viewed as just a flub, right?
Exactly, like a classic Bidenism.
Yeah, exactly. That, like, the gas used to be part of, you know, it used to be personality quirks for him, and that now they're being seen, rightly or wrongly, as a reflection of his age or lack of memory. But it also seems like a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, and that people want to see more of Biden being engaged and asking those tough questions and having those, like, quick responses, and that he's, like, clearly active and thinking a lot about the kind of thorny issues of the country right now, but that when he does do that and engage and he has a gaffe, then people use it against him.
And I think that's exactly what his aides are worried about, and that's why they're so careful about where they put him out.
After the break, what to expect at tomorrow's State of the Union address and what the next few months of the Biden campaign might look like. We'll be right back.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you, you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters? And why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat. Available now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
So, Yasmeen, you also mentioned that the Biden campaign sees a couple upcoming opportunities to get their message out there in a better way about why Biden actually is fit for president again and to set things in a new direction. Tell me more about what they're thinking in terms of coming weeks.
So what the Biden camp sees as their biggest opportunity is the State of the Union tomorrow night. So they know that this is probably going to be the most people who watch Biden all at once from now until November. They felt like the State of the Union last year, where Biden was sort of impromptu sparring with Republican members over cuts to Social Security and Medicare.
Instead of making the wealthy pay their fair share, some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority. Let me give you, anybody who doubts it, contact my office. I'll give you a copy of the proposal.
And those clips got a lot of attention, was super successful. And so they're hoping to replicate that, show Biden in this setting where he's touting his accomplishments. Who knows if he'll maybe try to pick a fight with some Republican members or do something quick on his feet to show that he's still with it. He's still, quick-witted, to show people that he is up to the job. He's ready for this campaign. So they view that as their biggest opportunity, because Biden will obviously do a number of campaign events over the coming few months. But they know that this is going to be their highest viewed event for the president.
But also, nobody watches the State of the nobody real watches the State of the Union. And that's obviously a gross overstatement. But I do question whether people really are that engaged in watching this speech, and that this is going to be an opportunity for the American public to really wrap their heads around Biden.
Yeah, the Biden camp can sometimes have sort of old school views of big media events and big events to turn things around. I mean, on the one hand, they've created a TikTok account and they do memes and, try to reach younger voters that way. Sure. They're working with influencers. And on the other hand, they see the State of the Union, which used to be a huge event for a president, and it still is. It's just, I don't know, like you said, how many of the key voters they're trying to reach would watch this and fundamentally change their minds about Biden because of it. But all I know is they view this as a big moment to try to turn things around and to try to start quelling some of these concerns that have hung over Biden's candidacy since he announced he was running again almost a year ago.
I've heard a joke that it feels very like the West Wing to think that the State of the Union is going to be this shining moment where, everything changes on this night with this one speech and the power of his words. And I don't know if that's the reality of today.
I guess we'll see. I'm a little bit skeptical we could replicate a West Wing episode tomorrow night, but I'm always open to being disproven.
I also was kind of struck by headlines around who is or is not going to be a guest at the State of the Union on Thursday. Obviously, every year they bring in high-profile people that it's part of sending some kind of message. And generally, I think people accept those invitations, but this year, not so much. And specifically, I'm talking about Ukraine's First Lady, Olena Zelenska, who has declined the invitation from the Biden administration to be in attendance. Talk to me about what is happening there.
I think we're at a very precarious moment for Biden right now. Ukraine was going to be probably one of the key planks of his foreign policy achievements, that he had brought this Western coalition together, maintained U.S. support, even as there was all this growing Republican skepticism. And I think it was a few months ago a little bit hard to imagine for the White House that we would be at this point where Ukraine has run out of money from the U.S. Biden has said in high-profile speeches, frontline soldiers are really struggling. They don't have enough munitions. In the last few weeks, Russia was able to take back a key city in Ukraine after the war had been at an effective stalemate for more than a year. And so there is a big risk now that Ukraine will not win the war or will have to concede more than it once hoped to Russia because it's not getting the billions in U.S. funding. For context, the White House asked for $60 billion to get Ukraine through the next year with the hope that you wouldn't have to vote on this again before the presidential election. But it's looking increasingly unlikely. And now we're into March. The White House was warning in December that they were about to run out of money and had no other options. There's really no sign that the Ukraine bill is going – it's part of a broader national security bill that has passed the Senate, but – the House Speaker Mike Johnson has so far refused to bring it up, and it's not clear that he will. It's not clear that the U.S. is going to be able to deliver that funding for Ukraine, and as such, it leaves the fate of the war into very uncertain territory because the U.S. was the biggest backer of Ukraine for the last 2 years.
So our understanding is that the Ukrainian First Lady is essentially like, well, because of your actions, like, we might lose this war. Why am I going to show up to your big speech?
I mean, they have depended on the U.S. and Biden and his aides all kept saying however long it takes, whatever it takes, they'll keep funding Ukraine. And that is obviously not the case right now. Of course, it's not Biden's fault per se in that he is very supportive of this. Mm-hmm. He's made several speeches to try to get this funding, but it's not passing and it's not getting through, you know, what is the political reality, which is a Republican-controlled House in which a growing portion of the party is very skeptical of foreign aid in general and has been sort of beating the drum on stopping aid to Ukraine.
But in some ways, Yasmin, as you pointed out earlier, this is, in fact, a good time for Biden. Like, by a lot of indications, the economy is doing pretty well, though I don't think it feels that way to a lot of people. Can you talk about some of the strengths that Biden has in this moment and the positive things he has to talk about and why the process of delivering that message is a little bit more complicated for him?
On paper, he's had a pretty successful first term. Of course, the war in Gaza has complicated that and then everything we were talking about on Ukraine. But if you look at what he was able to pass through Congress, they passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which had hundreds of billions of dollars for the environment. They passed a bipartisan bill to boost the semiconductor industry in the U.S. And so you've had factories opening up and a lot of new jobs being created. They passed the burn pits bill to help veterans with health care from burn pits that can result from being posted overseas. And they passed a more than $1 trillion infrastructure bill. And so Biden, we sort of joke he's been like the mayor president in some ways because he's gone all to these bridge openings and tunnel repairs mm-hmm. and things that matter a lot to people in cities. They've done a lot to address lead in water pipes and in a lot of cities. They're very proud of that. So he has a number of things to boast about. There are some healthcare initiatives that he'll, of course, want to showcase in the State of the Union, like capping the cost of insulin at $35 for seniors, allowing Medicare to negotiate the price of a handful of drugs. So he has plenty to boast about in the State of the Union, and he will. But I think what has been so frustrating to the White House and to the campaign is there seems to be this massive disconnect between what Biden has actually done and what people perceive him to have done.
And that's really borne out in the polls, right?
Exactly. You know, on a lot of issues, you see Trump with a big lead over Biden in terms of who voters trust more to handle that issue on the economy. Trump has a big lead. I think this is an enormous source of frustration for the Biden camp because they have good economic indicators. There was not the recession that almost everyone thought was inevitable. Consumer sentiment is starting to go back up. I think the flip side on the economy is that even though inflation has come down, the prices of groceries and just sort of household goods that people need to buy are still very high. So people still don't feel great about the economy, even though there's very low unemployment. The stock market is strong. All the indicators are sort of moving in the right direction. So I think there has always been this source of frustration. It's sort of been there for most of Biden's presidency where they feel like they're getting a lot done, but they're not getting rewarded for it. And they've always sort of struggled with how does Biden talk about his accomplishments? What does he do? What sorts of events does he hold to make sure people know that he is responsible for these things and that he gets credit? And I think they're still struggling with that, even though we're just a few months out from the election.
But I think it's also worth pointing out that Biden is a very experienced campaigner. A lot of the people around him are very experienced in kind of effectively using money and strategy in the remaining months of a race to get where they want to go. And talk to me a little bit about like what's happening in terms of the money and the kind of around the country strategy and the ground game.
Biden has been an extremely effective fundraiser. He has a huge cash advantage over Trump. I think in terms of the ground game, you know, there is this big push planned for right after the State of the Union. Biden will travel. All of his top aides will sort of fan out across the country trying to get his message out and reiterate what he said in the State of the Union. And now we are all but at the point that the Biden camp has been waiting for, where it is the head-to-head contest with Trump. And they have been saying for months now, voters aren't paying attention. Once it's a head-to-head contest with Trump, the dynamic of the race is going to change. So I think over the next few weeks, we'll really see that put to the test. They are both going to lock up the nomination unless there's some big extenuating circumstance. And then it's going to be that contest that the Biden camp has been promising is going to start changing the dynamic of the race. So Biden has been out there quite a bit already over the last few weeks, fanning out across the country. He was at the border last week, trying to go on the offensive on immigration. He's been going to all different states and cities, touting his accomplishments and really hitting back harder at Trump. I think we'll see him ramp up his attacks on Trump in the coming weeks, now that we're sort of effectively in the presidential race and the primaries are over. So I think we'll start to see whether all these advantages they feel they have, the war chest they've built up, the weaknesses they've seen, where Trump is performing. Of course, that doesn't mean Biden doesn't have his own weaknesses, but whether they're able to start capitalizing on that and turning things around and seeing a shift in the polls as a result.
And specifically when it comes to money, I mean, does Biden have more money for this campaign than Trump currently does?
He does. And the other thing that Trump is battling is that he has a huge mountain of legal bills. So we don't know how much of Trump's money is going to go to the campaign versus paying for his legal bills. Biden, of course, does not have that problem. So we'll see how it manifests over the next few months.
So given that we are at this moment where, like it or not, these are the two candidates that are in the race and we are just barreling toward November, what are the questions that you have going forward about how things are going to play out in the next couple of months?
Well, one thing is I know that the next few months are an eternity. So whatever polls show right now is not what's going to be the case a month from now, 3 months from now, 6 months from now. I don't know how much attention the whole country has been paying to Trump right now in terms of his rhetoric, what he's saying, what he's promising to do in a second term. There does seem to be this phenomenon where people have sort of forgotten what a Trump presidency was like, and they're unhappy with Biden, they're unhappy with how things are going. And so I think more people are willing to gravitate towards Trump right now. But I do wonder if, and this is the theory of the case in the Biden camp, once it is fully a head-to-head contest between Biden and Trump, and there is more attention paid to Trump's rhetoric, what he's promising to do in a second term, all the way his court cases play out, whether that starts to change the nature of the campaign at all. And also, in terms of these uncommitted votes that we were talking about, the suburban and moderate voters that Trump was really struggling with in the primaries, just how much those people swing over the next few months, and whether the Biden team's efforts to try to get more credit for these accomplishments, to put the president out there more, is there anything they can fundamentally do to change people's perception of Biden? I think those are some of the big things I'm going to watch over the next few months.
All right. Well, I will be watching that with you. Yasmeen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yasmeen Abutaleb is a White House reporter for The Post. Before we go, here are a couple of other stories we're following today. A missile launched by Houthi militants in Yemen struck a commercial vessel in the Gulf of Aden in the Arabian Sea on Wednesday. According to U.S. officials, two people were killed. These are the first known fatalities in the Houthis' campaign of violence against maritime traffic in the Gulf, a campaign that has been going on for months. The Houthis have described these attacks as a response to Israel's actions in Gaza. And an investigation by The Post has found that key government labs tasked with overseeing artificial intelligence are in poor shape, like really poor shape. A lack of funding has left some workers at the National Institute of Standards and Technology fighting off decrepit working conditions, everything from leaky roofs to black mold. And according to The Post reporting, there is a resources gap at the heart of President Biden's ambitious plans to oversee AI safety. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Emma Talkoff with help from Savvy Robinson. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Monica Campbell. If you are looking for the latest updates on the big news of the day, check out our morning news briefing, The 7. We bring you the 7 stories that you need to know about every weekday morning by 7 a.m. You can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or by following the link in our show notes. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you, you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters? And why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat. Available now.